whispers. Him? The woman says.
The asshole,
he whispered. The man is now face to face with the paramedic. What's happening here?
Emergency call. Heart attack. Who are you?
Richard Headley, he says. My father owns this building, among others. I'm the property manager.
Do you live here? The woman asks.
Headley looks as though he's been slapped in the face.
Hardly.
I come by twice a month, check on things, collect rent.
My mom's dead, Chris says.
Headley looks down at the boy, noticing him for the first time.
Sorry to hear that, sport.
If they'd got up here sooner, Chris says, holding back his tears.
They could have saved her. If you'd fixed the elevators.
Going up and down the stairs killed her.
It's your fault.
Headley bends down so he can look the kid in the eye. One thing you'll learn when you get older is you can't go blaming others for your troubles. If your mom didn't like the way things were here, she could have moved. He pats the boy's shoulder as he stands back up. But he isn't done doling out advice for the grief-stricken young man. We all have setbacks in life, but we move on. If there's something you want in life, you go after it, no matter how hard it is or how long it takes. These are the words Chris will always remember. 70. The mayor screamed, a ragged cry of pain and grief and disbelief.
Glover!
The name resounded through the glass-enclosed space. The crowd, transfixed in horror, suffered a brief, collective bout of heart failure, not quite accepting what they had just seen. It was all too impossible to believe. One moment Glover was there, and a moment later he wasn't. The mayor's son had barely had a chance to utter a scream of his own, and his plunge down the shaft took so long that no one heard a thing when he hit bottom. Headley started pushing his way through the crowd toward Chris Valens, a wild, murderous look in his eyes. But from somewhere, Valens had produced a gun and he was pointing it straight at the mayor. Stop, Richard, he said, utterly calm, utterly cold. Headley halted, a few feet away from Barbara. A second earlier, he'd looked ready to kill Valens, but now the enormity, the sheer horror of what had just happened was overtaking him. The mayor was on the verge of weeping, but was too stunned, too overwhelmed, to actually cry.
Go ahead. Let it out, Valens said, keeping his gun trained on Headley while he crouched down and reached back with his free hand for an open backpack that was propped against the short stretch of wall between two open elevator doors. He stood slowly, hefting the backpack over one shoulder while holding the gun in his opposite hand. A tear escaped Headley's right eye and ran down his cheek as he stared incredulously at Valens.
It hurts, doesn't it? Chris said. It hurts a lot.
Why did you...
You really don't remember, do you? You have no idea.
I don't know what...
Let me give you a hint. A 12-year-old boy, mother dead of a heart attack, couldn't handle going up all those flights of stairs anymore. You wouldn't spend a dime on that building. We had no heat half the time. Rusty water coming out of the taps. Mice and rats and cockroaches. Holes in the ceiling where water dripped down from shitty plumbing on the upper floors. But most of all, we had no fucking elevators. The only things you ever replaced were the not-in-service signs. You killed her, Richard. There was a dawning realization in Headley's eyes.
Valance, he whispered. Your mother was Maud.
I wondered if you'd recognize the name when you hired me. Chris smiled. But it had been so long, and you never asked.
I'm sorry, the mayor said. But, Glover, you didn't have to.
I didn't have to do anything, Chris said, shifting the backpack around to the front so he could see into it. I didn't have to mess with the elevators at your good friend Morris Lansing's building. I didn't have to have some fun with the elevators at the Sycamores, where one of your biggest fundraisers was held. Pretty sure I saw Margaret earlier. And I didn't have to fuck with the elevator at the Gormley building, where your good friend Mr. Steele lives. But I wanted to. I wanted to send a message to all those who gave you a helping hand. The kind you never gave anyone. I wanted to send a message to the people who helped put you where you are, when you so don't deserve to be there. But not the taxi bombing, Barbara thought. It didn't fit. It never had. Valens looked down again into the backpack and smiled. Ah, here we go. What he pulled out looked like an oversized TV remote. Barbara thought back to that news conference when that city official said there were devices out there that same size that could allow someone to commandeer a building's elevators. He let the backpack drop to the floor. So, Chris said, holding the remote at eye level so everyone could see it. This is my little friend that's your ticket out of here. With this, I can return the elevators back to their normal functions. You'll all be able to go home. Just don't anyone think of rushing me, or trying to jump me, or I'm going to toss it down the shaft. Are we clear on that? There were a few nods among the guests. Awesome, he said. But there is an if. One big if. Please. Headley said. Don't hurt anyone here. You want to toss me down there, let me be with my son? Fine. I'll jump right in if you'll let these people go. Here's what we're going to do, Valens said. I'm going to let you go.
What?
Headley said, his voice cracking. That's right. I'm going to bring one elevator up, and you can get on it. And I'm going to send it, very safely, back to the lobby.
I don't understand. Why would you let me?
Valens raised a finger on the hand holding the gun. Let me finish. The mayor went silent. You'll get off in the lobby, and I'll bring the elevator back up without you. Then you'll take the stairs. And rejoin us.
I'm... What?
Valens smiled and nodded. You're going to walk your way back up here. Well, almost. He paused. See how you like it. Now you're in pretty good shape for a man your age, although I don't know how often you run to the tops of skyscrapers. We're going to make it interesting. We're going to put a time limit on it. I'm going to give you 20 minutes.
20?
That seems more than enough time. When they had a race to get to the top of the Freedom Tower, there were people who did it in under 15. so I think I'm being generous. The only thing is, the clock starts ticking as soon as you get on the elevator to go down.
This is... And what if I'm late?
You heard the four explosions that took out the stairwells. There's a fifth bomb just waiting to go off that will pretty much take off the top of this building. Everyone here, including myself, will die. So if you decide to run away, to not come back, that's what's going to happen. The mayor stood there, speechless. Barbara leaned forward, close enough to the mayor to whisper to him and be heard. She said,
"You should get going."
Richard Headley's eyes met hers.
"I'm sorry," he said, "for everything."
Barbara felt as though the room was spinning. Then the mayor looked at Arla, took both her hands in his, and squeezed.
"What a wonderful young woman you've turned out to be. I've only had an instant to be proud of you."
Arla appeared to be on the verge of fainting.
"Thank you," she whispered.
"Time's a-wastin'," Valens said. Headley let go of Arla's hands. Valens looked at Barbara and said, "Do me a solid and set the timer on your phone to 20 minutes.
"Okay,"
Barbara said with feigned calm. She reached into her clutch and brought out her phone. At that moment, it dinged. An incoming email. "That'll be from me," Valens told her. "Sent on a delay. You can read it later, if you get the chance. Got the timer ready?" She fiddled with some settings, then said,
"Ready."
"Hold it up and show me," Valens asked, and she did. Valens looked at the mayor. "How about you, set to go?" Headley swallowed and said,
"I'm ready."
"We're on 98, but call me when you get to the 97th floor. Valens smiled. "You have my number. I'll send an elevator to bring you up the last story." Headley nodded that he understood. He reached into his jacket to make sure he had his phone. He looked at it, brought up Valens's number, then returned it to his pocket. Valens, keeping the gun trained on him, entered some instructions into the remote control elevator device with his other hand. Seconds later, an elevator car arrived. Valens swept his arm gracefully toward it, inviting the mayor to board. Headley walked forward, got into the car, turned and looked at the crowd, his chin quivering. Valens pressed another button, and the door closed. He then looked at Barbara and said, "Go." She tapped start on the timer app and held the phone up to show him. Valens smiled. "Don't you go pausing it on me now, or I'm gonna be mad."
"Okay."
"We've got some time to kill while we wait for Richard to return," he said to everyone. "Go ahead and enjoy yourselves. Have a good time. Enjoy the food." He pursed his lips. "I'll tell you this. If anyone's offering, I wouldn't say no to a shrimp."
71. Jerry Burke was hunched over, hands on his knees, looking down into the shaft where he'd lost his inhaler. "Oh, fuck," he said. But then he craned his neck around to get a peek up the shaft instead of down.
"What the hell was that?"
"I heard four blasts," Delgado said, standing beside him and briefly placing a comforting hand on his back. She felt it rise and fall in rhythm with the wheezes emanating from his throat. She glanced back down the hallway at the four apartment doors.
"I can't believe no one came out to see what's going on," she said.
Burke, slowly standing back up, said,
"I read that people weren't moving in
until after the opening bash, and anyone who's moved in already is probably at the party. Except for the top floor, the building's probably deserted.
Delgado slowly shook her head.
Some folks are gonna want their deposit back.
She took a phone from the purse slung over her shoulder, tapped it.
This is Detective Lois Delgado. I'm with Detective Jerry Burke, and we are on the 65th floor of the top of the park. The elevators have been disabled, and we heard explosions that sound like they're coming from the top. Send everything!
She listened to the person on the other end, said, "Got it," and then ended the call.
What?
Burke asked.
They know. Tons of 911 calls coming in. Look, how are you doing? You sound like a tea kettle.
Burke took several breaths, listened to the air struggling to get through his windpipe.
I'll be okay. Come on, we have to get up there.
Delgado shook her head adamantly.
No, no way. It's like 40 more stories. You take the stairs down, I'll head up. You're not going up there alone. God knows what's happened.
You'll fucking kill yourself if you go up there.
No,
he said and wheezed.
I can do it. There's backup coming. You don't? Yeah, well, we're about 60 flights of stairs ahead of whoever's coming next to help out.
He reached out and put a hand on his partner's shoulder.
It's in my head. There's...
And he stopped for another breath.
Nothing actually wrong with me. I just have to focus, and maybe I can get my wind back.
No, you have...
Quiz me,
he said.
What?
Give me a category.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
It's a trick my doctor gave me. I think about something else other than my breathing. Concentrate on a subject, like the city's tallest buildings. Although, right now, that's probably a bad choice. You know, 5 Spielberg movies. Name all the different Star Trek series, or what years the Yankees have won the World Series, or...
I've got one,
Delgado said. Burke blinked.
Okay, good, hit me.
Name 5 Ryan Gosling movies.
The corner of his mouth curled up.
Good one.
Wheeze.
Okay, the Blade Runner sequel, whatever they called that.
That's one.
Delgado held up one finger.
And La La Land,
he said. Wheeze.
That's 2. 3 to go.
The one where he was driving the car.
I need a title, Delgado said. I'm cutting you some slack missing the title of the Blade Runner sequel, but for this, I want the title.
Burke closed his eyes for a second.
Oh, fuck. Of course. Drive.
That's 3.
Okay,
he said. Wheeze.
There was that funny detective when he did with Russell Crowe. Good guys. No, the nice guys.
Well done,
Delgado said. Just one more.
God, this is tough. Maybe if I dreamt about him every night like you do, I'd...
No excuses,
Delgado said.
Oh,
he said, snapping his fingers.
That funny superhero, Deadpool.
Wheeze.
Oh, I'm sorry, she said. That was Ryan Reynolds.
They're not the same actor.
Delgado's eyes softened.
You're still short of breath. I can hear it. It sounds like you're getting worse. Jerry, how bad can this get without your puffer?
Bad,
he said. He had moved to a sitting position, his back to a short stretch of wall behind open elevator doors.
We need to get you help. We need to get paramedics up here.
Too long,
he wheezed.
Too far up.
Well, shit, what do we do? Christ, you need mouth to mouth.
He had just enough air to chuckle.
That sounds lovely, but I don't think it'll do anything.
There's got to be something. Look, I don't want to leave you here, but I got to head up. If you don't move, if you don't exert yourself, can you get enough air into your lungs that you're not going to fucking die on?
They heard a scream. It had come from one of the elevator shafts. Burke managed to shift his position in time to see, a heartbeat later, a tuxedoed man pass the open door immediately to their right, going down in a hurry. Burke and Delgado gasped, staring for several seconds into the space where the man had appeared for only a millisecond. If they had blinked, they would have missed him. Together, they moved tentatively to the opening and peered over the edge.
Delgado standing and Burke on his knees. Then Delgado looked up as if checking to see whether more were headed their way. They both moved back from the opening and looked at each other, each taking several breaths as they each waited for their pulses to stop racing.
Hey, said Delgado.
What?
Burke said.
Listen.
Burke thought, didn't we just do this a minute ago? He tilted his head, raised his chin as if putting his ear to the wind.
I don't hear anything, he said.
Me neither,
Delgado said. He looked at her, confused. Then it hit him.
The wheezing,
he said. He took several deep breaths without making a sound.
Son of a bitch.
What had the doctor told him? About how a sudden shock might reverse the psychosomatic condition? Just to be sure, he breathed in and out half a dozen more times and felt no restrictions in his air passages.
I know where the stairs are, he said. I've got the book.
72.
When the elevator doors opened onto the lobby of Top of the Park, Richard Headley was met with a crowd. Police officers, firefighters, and paramedics blocked his path.
Out of my way, he said. Out of my way!
As a few emergency workers stepped back to allow him to get off the elevator, others were getting on.
No,
he said.
He's controlling it. If you get on it, you'll die.
Once he was out of the car and the others had exited, it began to go up. Headley wasn't waiting around to watch. He was already looking for the closest stairwell door.
Mr. Mayor,
a woman's voice. Headley ignored as he spotted a sign pointing to the stairs.
Mr. Mayor!
Sharper this time, but he still did not respond as he looked for a way back to the top.
Richard!
He stopped, turned, and standing there was Chief Annette Washington. She reached out, touched his arm, and asked softly,
Do you know?
It took him a beat to understand what she was asking him. Everyone in the lobby, he realized, would have seen his son plummet past one of the open elevator doors. Glover would have had only a few below-ground level floors left to fall after they'd seen him. Headley nodded solemnly and said,
Glover.
She nodded back.
Can you see him? There's four levels below street level, she said. He's down there. We're going to get him out, Richard.
She paused.
I don't think you should look.
I will,
he said.
But not now. I have to go back up. There's not much time.
What's going on? What were those explosions? He spotted a door to the stairs.
I'll have to run and talk,
he said, breaking away from her. She ran after him. In the stairwell, taking the steps two at a time, he told her, in bullet form, what had transpired. That his aide, Chris Valens, was behind the elevator events. That he'd given the mayor only a few minutes to climb his way back to the 98th floor. That if he didn't make it, another bomb would go off, killing everyone at the party.
Why?
Asked Washington, one step behind him.
Why is he doing all this?
Headley stopped, briefly, on the landing of the third floor and looked at her.
I've done terrible things, he said. You can't do this, she said. We'll send up a team. We'll find a way.
He gripped both her arms above the wrists and forced her to look into his eyes.
Annette, there is no time. Goodbye.
He turned and kept running up the stairs. Washington called after him.
Look for Detectives Burke and Delgado. They're up there somewhere.
If Headley heard, he gave no indication. He just kept running and climbing. As he passed a door marked floor 5, he started doing the math in his head. First, he needed to know how long it would take him to get from the 5th floor to the 6th. He counted. 15 seconds. Okay, he thought. Roughly 90 floors to go. 90 times 15 was 1,350. So, what was that in minutes? Headley had always been good at doing math without a calculator. He could look at city budget projections and do calculations in his head as quickly as any of the bean counters from the financial department. So, take 1,350 seconds and divide by the number of seconds per minute, which was, of course, 60 and 22 and a half minutes. God, no, he said aloud, rounding the landing between the 8th and 9th floors. Valens had given him 20 minutes, but the clock had started ticking the moment he got onto the elevator. He couldn't have more than 14 or 15 minutes left. There was no way he was going to make it. He increased his speed. 10 floors up now, his calves and thighs were already screaming in pain. He was still taking the steps two at a time, grabbing the railing each time and using it to pull himself upward. Like so much of the rest of his body, his shoulder was hurting like a son of a bitch. His chest felt as though it would explode. This is what he wants. He wants me to have a heart attack. I'm going to die the same way his mother did. What was the last thing the chief had shouted at him? Burke and Delgado? Weren't those the two detectives who'd come to City Hall looking for Glover? They were already in the building somewhere? Glover. Headley thought his heartache was more likely than a heart attack to do him in. He thought about those last accusatory words he'd said to his son before Valens had pushed him into the shaft, believing that his son could have had anything to do with this. How he would have to live with that forever. However long forever was. As he passed the door marked floor 14, he thought about what a curse he'd been to so many around him. All those tenants in his father's buildings. His wife. His son. All the bad luck he'd brought them. Maybe it was fitting he'd think of that at this moment, passing the 14th floor. Given people's superstitious nature, it was actually the 13th. 73. Valens nibbled on one of the shrimps Barbara had taken from the buffet table, put on a plate, and slid across the floor to him. These are excellent, he said, biting on one, then tossing the tail into the elevator shaft. He raised his voice. Everyone, please! Eat up, enjoy! While we can, Barbara thought. While none of the guests had much of an appetite. She'd seen more than a few head over to the bar. But most were huddled in pairs, standing quietly, eyes trained on Valens, wondering what he might do next, terrified by what he might do next. Valens shrugged when he didn't see anyone taking his advice, then looked over at Barbara and Arla, who were standing closer to him than anyone else. Sorry, Valens said to Barbara. She could not take her eyes off the device in his left hand and the gun in the other. You were right, of course. I was following you when you stepped out in front of that van. I saw you two at breakfast earlier. Then when I saw Arla at City Hall, I put it together and ratted her out to the boss. He gave Arla a regretful look.
I don't understand either, said Barbara. You want to bring the mayor down, but you were still doing his dirty work.
Valens nodded.
I've been doing his dirty work for some time.
That's how I got close. Anyway, it's all in the email. Barbara said,
Why didn't you just let the van run me down?
He shrugged. I told you. I like you.
Enough to let me, my daughter, go?
How would that look, playing favorites, he said. If anyone survives, I hope it's you. Otherwise, the email's pointless. I've always thought you were a good writer. You're the best one to tell the story.
Chris, please, let everyone go.
He shook his head.
Sometimes innocents are lost in the pursuit of a greater goal. If anyone here is really, truly innocent. Barbara's head twitched.
That was you. The comments on my article. You're the one calling himself going down.
Valen smiled. That was a bit cute, I know.
Help me out here, Chris. Haven't you sacrificed enough innocence already? Like my friend, Paula? Wasn't your mom an innocent? What's happening to these people? Is it any more unfair than what happened to her? Does anything you've done make sense? Does hurting all these people here tonight serve any purpose? You've taken his son from him, Chris.
What more do you want?
He was stone-faced. How's our time? Barbara looked at the phone in her hand.
7:20.
Valens nodded. Do you think he'll make it?
I don't know.
Do you think he's even trying? Maybe he got off in the lobby and buggered off home.
I doubt that,
Barbara said, although she was not 100% sure. It hadn't even occurred to her until Chris had posed the question that Headley might not even try to make the climb.
He'll try, she thought. He's a bastard, but no one could be that big a bastard. Is this how it ends for you? Barbara asked. I mean, you can't be thinking you're going to walk away from this.
Valens looked thoughtful.
You know, I always used to think those suicide bombers, those Islamic terrorists crazy screaming Allahu Akbar as they fire their machine guns into a crowded theater with no chance of getting out alive, what the hell is wrong with them? But I also sort of get it, you know? Because when you've been angry for so long, when the only thing you care about is justice, your own life stops having much meaning. What are we down to? Barbara looked.
6:25.
My mother was a wonderful woman.
Strong and proud and good. Not confrontational. She didn't like to make waves.
Would your mother be proud of you now?
Barbara asked.
Would she want you to get even this way?
He just smiled. Save your breath. Barbara sighed.
I'm guessing you were something of a techie, she said.
Yup. Always messed about with computers. Taught myself, mostly. Same was true with elevators. Studied every manual I could find, memorized them. But I still needed some help with that. Found someone to fine-tune my skills. Helped me figure out all the security stuff. But he and I, we had a bit of a falling out Sunday night. I had a feeling he was going to talk to the police. He'd stopped believing I had people watching members of his family. He was right about that. It was only ever just me. He paused, surveyed the room full of his hostages. Someone over by the window was softly crying.
Where are we on the clock? He asked Barbara.
She looked at the phone in her hand. The tenths of seconds flying past on the counter.
4:55, she said.
Valens nodded.
Doesn't look good.
He glanced toward the bar.
Last call, folks.
74. They were making good time. They were winded, their hearts were pounding, and their legs were killing them, but Burke and Delgado were nearing the top. Delgado had slowed briefly as she took a call from someone on the ground who wanted her to know that at some point they might run into the mayor, who was also in one of the four stairwells heading back up. She was quickly briefed. When she got off the phone, she called out to Burke, 3 steps ahead of her. There's some bad shit up ahead. She told him the body they'd seen flying by in the shaft was the man they'd come to talk to,
and that he had been pushed by one of the mayor's aides who evidently was the guy behind all the elevator mayhem. And that aide, Chris Valens, was holding court on the 98th floor, ready to blow the whole thing up if Headley didn't make it back up in time. Why? Burke asked, between pants.
Beats me, said Delgado. From what I gather, if we can't get to this guy in the next 10 minutes or so, it's not gonna matter.
As they reached the landing between the 95th and 96th floors, Burke stopped. Some painting equipment had been left there, tucked into the corner, a not unfamiliar sight on their trip skyward. Paint touch-ups being done throughout the building, but for the opening, workers' supplies had been tucked out of sight. To steady himself, Burke placed a hand on one of the steps of a 5-foot ladder and took a few breaths. Delgado stopped.
Are you okay?
I just need 1 second, he said.
Wheezing?
She asked. He shook his head.
No, just exhausted.
You're a fucking medical miracle, you are, Delgado said. Or a psychological one, not sure which.
Okay, Burke said. I'm good.
They continued on with the climb. Burke still couldn't believe he was okay. His doctor, Bert, had been right on the money about how he might come out of the shortness of breath that had been plaguing him for so long. Or maybe there was another explanation. Maybe it had something to do with duty. Duty to the job. Duty to his partner. Duty to Lois. He was not going to abandon her. He was not going to let her continue to the top of this building and face whatever was up there without him. And maybe that determination, that sense of conviction, was stronger than the mental dysfunction that had been converting his stress into a constriction of his windpipe. And what the fuck did it matter anyway? He could breathe, and he was doing this. One thing he knew with absolute certainty. If he got out of this alive, he was not going to make a cardboard replica of this goddamn building. Delgado, behind him at this point, said, "What's this?" The steps were starting to be littered with tiny pebbles of concrete.
"Must have something to do with the explosions we heard," Burke said. "We're almost there."
A pause, then,
"Hello."
They had just passed the door marked floor 97. Just one floor to go. But there was a small problem. There was a 4-step gap in front of them.
"Holy shit," Delgado said.
"There are 3 other stairwells,"
Burke said, reaching for the handle of the door to the 96th floor.
"How do you know that?" she asked.
"I told you. The plans are in the book I got."
Delgado nodded, briefly impressed, but she was still visibly worried.
"If the other stairways were passable, wouldn't people already be scrambling down them?"
"Stay here," he said. "I'll check. And if they're blown up too, I saw something that might be able to help us."
"No, we shouldn't split."
2 minutes,
he said, and started running back down the stairs. Not much more than a minute later, he reappeared with the painter's aluminum ladder, the one they had passed moments earlier, slung over his shoulder.
"Oh, God," Delgado said. "You gotta be kidding me."
"The other stairwells are no good. This is our best shot."
He rounded the top of the stairs, nearly clocking Delgado with the ladder as he went by.
"Is it long enough?"
she asked.
"It'll have to be."
He went to the last step before the gap and placed the ladder across it. It was long enough, but there was nothing to brace it against. Once anyone actually got on the ladder, it would slide and drop into the opening.
"I'll hold it," Delgado said.
"What?"
"I'll hold the bottom of it in place while you climb across. Then you hold it, and I'll follow."
Burke was skeptical.
"Are you sure?"
"I'm not the svelte athlete I once was."
"Yeah, like you were ever an athlete. Get a move on." Delgado planted her feet firmly on a lower step, knelt down, and placed both hands on the bottom rung of the ladder, which lay on a 45-degree angle across the opening. Burke, delicately, grabbed hold of a higher rung, then, careful not to hit his partner in the head, put his feet on a lower one that was just above her head. Now, all his weight was on the ladder.
"You okay?"
he asked.
she grunted. Move it, fatso.
Carefully, he made the crossing, looking ahead and not at the stairs a flight below or the sliver of space between sets of steps that appeared to go down to the depths of hell. Gingerly, he got himself onto the step on the other side of the divide, taking his weight off the ladder. Delgado let out a long breath as Burke planted his butt on the second step after the gap, leaned over, and gripped the top of the ladder.
Okay, he said.
Delgado got onto the ladder as tentatively as her partner had. She made the crossing slowly. As she reached the other side, Burke leaned over slightly to give her room to get a grip on the closest concrete step. As her legs were coming off the last step of the ladder, her foot slipped and pushed hard on the upper rung. Burke lost his grip, and the ladder fell, hitting the lower stairwell with a loud, metallic crash. Delgado clung to the step, her legs dangling in space. Burke got his hands under her arms and pulled. She scrambled to get hold of the next step, and once she had it, and her waist was over the threshold of the step below, she pulled herself up the rest of the way.
I guess we better hope there's another ladder at the top so we can get back down, she said.
They both got to their feet, and, after taking a second to pull themselves together, walked up the rest of the way to the door marked floor 98. They each took a moment to take out their weapons. Once they both had a gun in hand, Burke grasped the handle of the fire door.
Kinda wish I'd worn a vest, Delgado said.
Burke slowly opened the door. 75. Richard Headley knew there was no way he'd make it. He wasn't using anything as accurate as a stopwatch app on his phone, but he'd been glancing regularly at the Rolex strapped to his wrist, and his 20 minutes were nearly up. And he had some 30 floors to go. Not gonna happen. Those people are all going to die. Because of me. But even though he knew it was hopeless, he kept going. He'd taken off his bow tie around the 20th floor so he could open up the collar of his shirt. He was soaked with perspiration. Once he'd hit the 30th floor, he slipped off the jacket of his tux and dropped it on the steps, making sure before he did it that he had his phone. His white dress shirt was translucent with sweat. It was running down his neck and forehead, getting into his eyes and stinging.
Keep going. Keep going.
He glanced again at his watch. The 20 minutes had to be up.
What the hell am I going to?
And then it hit him.
Stall.
He had the messaging app open, the name Valens at the top of the screen. He stopped long enough to text one word. Here. He kept going, looking every few seconds to see if there would be a reply. It came within 10 seconds.
Wow.
And with 3 seconds to spare. Headley kept climbing. Very impressive. Sending your ride to 97. So the elevator was on the way. But it would be there waiting for him long before Headley could get to it. How long would it take for the elevator to come from the lobby or wherever else Valens might have sent it in the interim to the 97th floor? A minute? Headley kept going, one foot ahead of the other. His phone chimed. Are you aboard? Headley stopped, typed his reply with a sweaty thumb. No. Several seconds passed. Headley managed to ascend another story. Get on. Headley stopped. Elevator not here. Headley knew it was a lie that would not buy him much time. All Valens had to do was look down the shaft to know the elevator was where it was supposed to be. The elevator car would be one floor below. He'd be able to see its roof.
And then, just as he feared, it's there.
Think, think, think. What couldn't Valens see?
Headley put his thumb to the screen.
Doors closed. Open the door.
Let him think on that for a moment. Headley ran past floor 72. Still so far to go. Three dancing dots appeared on the mayor's phone. It should be open. The mayor wrote back, it's not. And then the phone in the mayor's hand rang. Valens. Headley stopped, took the call.
What do you mean the doors aren't open?
Valens shouted.
I'm right here, Headley said. The other four doors are wide open, but the doors in front of the elevator aren't.
That's not fucking possible,
the man said angrily.
Look, you're the guy hogging the remote, not me, Headley said. Send me one of the other elevators, and this time, if you're such a fucking genius, make sure the door's open.
He paused.
Remember, we had a deal. I get back in time, you let everyone go. Well, I made it. Only reason I'm not up there now is you fucked up. That's on you, not me.
Valens was silent for a moment.
I don't believe you.
Then why don't you bring up another elevator for yourself and come down one floor and see it with your own eyes?
Headley, waiting for Valens to reply, passed floor 76.
Okay,
Valens said finally. I'll send another elevator.
Because I really, really want you to get back here.
76. As quietly as possible, Detective Jerry Burke opened the door to the 98th floor and slipped in. He was expecting to hear screams and other sounds of panic, but instead what he heard were soft whimpers and crying, and just one man talking very loudly. Burke already had a finger to his lips in case any of the hostages spotted him, which a few did almost instantly. While there were some barely audible gasps, no one did anything stupid like shout, "Police are here!" Everyone instinctively understood that the arrival of Burke and Delgado might be their only hope of getting out of the top of the park alive. The stairwell door was tucked around the corner from the elevators, but they could hear the man continuing to shout.
"That's not fucking possible," he said.
Burke poked his head around the corner, far enough for one eye to take in the scene. Valens was by the elevator, gun in one hand, the phone in the other. Amazingly, the first thing Burke thought was, this guy is bald. The man who'd been talking to Otto Petrenko by the car had hair, but then again it had looked like a rug. On the floor, right by Valens's foot, was a black box, some kind of device. Burke wondered whether it could be a bomb. It did not look like one, but then again, how many bombs had Burke seen in his career? But it looked more like a piece of electronic equipment. The good news, if there was any, was that it was not in Valens's hands at this moment. Burke, like his partner, had his gun pointing toward the floor, but once they rounded that corner, they would have to be in a firing position. Could he take the shot? Was anyone standing close to Valens? Anyone directly behind him? There were some people to his right, a few steps farther away from the open elevator door he was standing beside. But there appeared to be no one behind him. At one point, as Valens continued to argue with someone on his phone, he glanced down into the shaft. No one else is coming, Burke thought. Lois and I are on our own. Backup is 98 floors away. We might as well be on the moon. He tightened his grip on his weapon. Now or never. It all happened in under 10 seconds. Burke stepped out from behind the corner, gun raised.
Drop your weapon, he shouted.
He knew Delgado had moved out too and was at his back. Valens snapped his head in Burke's direction, dropped the phone, brought up the arm holding the gun, and Jerry Burke thought,
Lois is right behind me. Do not duck. Do not dive out of the way. Do not make the same mistake again.
Holding his ground, Burke fired at the exact same moment as Valens. Valens stumbled backward, the bullet ripping into his right shoulder. As he stumbled, his foot knocked the device closer to the open shaft. Burke, hit in the stomach, went down. Screams. Her partner having dropped to the floor, Delgado had a clear shot at Valens, who was still standing despite being hit. She fired, four times. Bang, 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 bang. Valens jerked spasmodically as the bullets slammed into his thigh, chest, and neck. One missed and spiderwebbed one of the observation deck windows. He dropped to the floor, once again knocking the black box. It skittered several inches closer to the open elevator doors. A woman holding a cell phone, who'd been standing closest to Valens, dived forward, actually sailing through the air and landing across his bloodied body, her elbows hitting the marble floor as she scrambled to grab hold of the device before it had a chance to tumble out of sight. The device was halfway over the sill of the open doorway when she snatched it with her right hand. She brought it close to her chest, smothering it with both hands as if it were a football. "Touchdown," she whispered to herself. Friday, 77. Horror at the Top of the Park by Barbara Matheson. It's a cliche, but sometimes cliches are on the money. Our nightmare is over. The city's, anyway. The nightmares are unlikely to ever end for those directly touched by the horrors of this week. The ripples from these events will be felt for years to come. Tell me about it. Anyone who was on the 98th floor of Top of the Park will never forget what happened last night, and you can count this writer among them. We all had little expectation that we would survive. Had it not been for the heroic actions of NYPD detectives Jerry Burke and Lois Delgado, who knows what might have happened? We all wish Detective Burke in the hospital and listed in serious but improving condition a speedy recovery. And while it's becoming increasingly clear that the origins of this tragic week can be traced back to decisions made by a young Richard Headley, his own actions last night were probably what bought those two detectives enough time to bring down the terrorist behind the elevator disasters. Even though Headley had no time to grieve the death minutes earlier of his son Glover, he played the game that terrorist wanted him to play in a bid to save the hostages. As everyone knows by now, Mayor Headley was found dead of an apparent heart attack in the stairwell, just shy of the 95th floor. I had, as regular readers of this column know, been a harsh critic of the mayor, but must admit, I am reassessing some of my feelings about him. There are things that I, and at least one other person I know, would have liked to have told him if we'd had the chance. Another big thank you is owed to one of the city's elevator inspectors, who managed to reach the top floor and, using the device the terrorist had used to commandeer the elevators, bring the cars back online and safely get everyone out of the building. There was obviously a sense of urgency, given that there was believed to be a fifth bomb in the top of the park. But as I write this, no further explosive devices have been found, although the search is ongoing and the streets around Top of the Park remain closed as a precaution. Now, about that terrorist. I hesitate to use his name here, because people who perpetrate these kinds of acts revel in a kind of perverse notoriety. But I need to tell you about Chris Valens. I got to know him a little this week before I knew he was, as the tabloids are now calling him, the elevator executioner.
I liked him. He seemed like a decent guy. I watched him give his gloves to a homeless man.
But we know now that he blackmailed an elevator technician into teaching him everything he knew,
making him believe members of his extended family would be killed if he failed to go along. We know he killed that man, beat his face to a pulp and cut off his fingertips to hinder identification when he feared the man was going to expose him. We know he plotted for years to gain the confidence of the mayor to exact his revenge and had spent months getting into a number of buildings to prepare the elevators for failure. We know he killed many innocent people when he took over the control of three of them. The question is why. He explained it all to me in an email I was able to read only today. He did it out of love. Love for his mother, who had been deeply wronged years ago by a young Richard Headley. You've probably already read or heard all about that by now, so no sense repeating it all here. Are there any lessons in all this? I wouldn't presume to be wise enough to know. But I can say this much. Actions have consequences. Maybe not overnight. Maybe not in a week, or a month, or even a decade. But the things we do, the decisions we make, the way we treat other people, it all becomes part of the equation. Eventually, things have a way of balancing out. Or maybe this is all just a load of bullshit. Honestly, I don't know anymore. That's why this is my last column, at least for the foreseeable future, for Manhattan Today. Barbara took one last look at the piece on her screen and hit send. The entire time she'd been typing, she'd been resting her right elbow on an ice pack, hitting the floor when she dived to grab the elevator control device had made that earlier injury worse. Now that she was done writing her piece, the pack was warming. She flexed her arms, then leaned back in her kitchen chair, reached for her coffee, and took a sip. She hadn't yet slept. There'd been police to talk to, statements to make. It was 4 a.m. before she and Arla got back to her apartment. Arla was too shaken up to head back to her own place. The good news was she'd managed to fall asleep in Barbara's bed shortly after they'd come through the door. Barbara had stripped off her blood-soaked gown and put on some sweats. It wasn't long before she opened up the laptop and started to write. Around 11 a.m, Barbara heard rustling in the bedroom. She looked toward the door and saw Arla emerge, her hair a tousled mess.
Hey, Barbara said. Have you even been to bed?
Arla asked. Barbara shook her head.
There's always time to sleep. How are you doing? Okay, I guess. A bit numb. I can't believe all those things happened.
She brushed some hair from her eyes.
I can't believe we're alive. Yeah, there's that. Is there more coffee?
Barbara pointed. Arla found a mug, poured herself some, and as she sat down at the table said,
I just find out I have a brother, and find out who my father is, and then lose them both.
Barbara reached out a hand. Arla gripped it.
You're gonna want to talk to someone, maybe. Her mother said. I know you've seen someone before.
Arla looked into her mother's face.
I can talk to you.
Barbara gave the hand another squeeze. Arla said,
I should get back to my place. You sure? You can stay here as long as you like. No, I should get back.
She smiled sadly.
need to update my resume.
Sure.
Barbara paused.
I'll see you home. Can you stay awake that long?
Barbara knew eventually she would crash and crash hard.
But not just yet.
While Arla showered, Barbara got into something slightly more presentable than her sweats. Jeans and a pullover sweater. When Arla was done in the bathroom, Barbara handed her some of her own clothes she believed would fit her. They took a cab to Arla's. On the way, Arla leaned over and rested her head on her mother's shoulder. They didn't speak. Barbara paid the driver, and the two of them went into Arla's building. When they got to the elevator, another woman was standing there, nicely dressed, silvery hair, pearl earrings. She was carrying a Whole Foods bag. Arla nodded at her.
Hey.
The woman smiled politely. Arla turned to her mother.
This is the woman I was telling you about.
Barbara blinked, not understanding. The woman looked at Arla, who said,
You're the book editor, right?
She nodded.
That's right.
The elevator doors parted, and the three of them stepped on. The woman pressed the button for the 10th floor, while Arla hit 12.
My mom's got an idea for a book,
Arla said, smiling.
Maybe a couple.
Oh, said the woman, doing a very good job of concealing her excitement. Arla prodded her mother.
Tell her.
You'll have to be quick, the editor said. I'm getting off at 10.
Barbara smiled tiredly.
I don't think we'll need that much time.
Hi, this is Linwood Barclay. I hope you enjoyed listening to Elevator Pitch. A lot goes on behind the scenes of writing a novel, so now I'm going to answer some of your questions about my process. The first question comes from Maria Pace, who asks, which book or author had the greatest influence on you as a young person? It has to be Ross MacDonald. Ross MacDonald, whose real name was Kenneth Miller, was a crime writer, often considered by many to be kind of the heir to the throne. That went from Dashiell Hammett to Raymond Chandler, and then to MacDonald, who wrote about a private detective named Lou Archer, and he wrote primarily through the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. And I discovered him through a novel called The Goodbye Look, which I found on a paperback rack when I was 15 years old. And this book just made such an impression on me because here was a guy who was taking the conventions of the mystery novel, which I was addicted to mystery novels, and he was doing more with it. He was using it to explore social issues and troubled families and so forth. And I just became obsessed with his books, to the point that I actually wanted to do a thesis on his work when I was in university, and I wrote to him, care of his publisher, he wrote back, and we had a long correspondence, all of which culminated in when he was on a trip to Canada. He called up and asked if I wanted to have dinner. So here was, I realized, able to have dinner with my favorite writer on the planet. And he was very supportive. He was something of a mentor to me. So, he personally had a major impact on me. I think I really learned how much you could do in a crime novel by reading Ross MacDonald. Elaine Murray asks, do you ever write a scenario and have someone follow the path that you would choose, or do you make them do the exact opposite? I'm not quite sure what Elaine's getting at here, but it does lead me to make a comment about something. And I think that's when you are writing something and you expect it to go a certain way, or you expect your characters to do a certain thing. And when I'm writing a thriller, as I kind of get close to the end of a chapter, I think, well, what is the logical way for this chapter to end? And then I think, is there some way to not make that happen? So that every time you hit the end of a chapter, there is a twist, not necessarily a big one, but even a small, minor twist that's just enough to make you think, I have to read the next chapter now. And so that often does happen. I'm always looking for ways that I can get the characters maybe to surprise me or get them to surprise the reader, to always sort of throw something at you that you're not quite expecting. Matthew Bass asks, if you could select any of your books to be adapted into a film, which would you personally choose and why? Well, I'm lucky enough that one book has been made into a movie. A novel I wrote called Never Saw It Coming was adapted into a film in Canada last year with Eric Roberts and Emily Hampshire, and I was lucky enough to be able to write the screenplay for that. But of the rest of the books, I think certainly the most recent one, the one we're talking about today, Elevator Pitch, is the one that is probably the most cinematic, lends itself, I really think, to a film. But I've done other books that I would love to see become a movie. Probably more than any other, I'd love to see, well, there's two. A Noise Downstairs, which is my most recent book before this one, which I think would make a great little thriller. And then I did a book a few years ago that was kind of an updated Rear Window called Trust Your Eyes, about a fellow who's absolutely obsessed with maps, and he spends every waking moment of the day on a Google Street View type site and thinks that he sees a murder that has happened in a window, in an image that has been captured among millions, and who knows when. And there's been a couple of attempts to make that into a film, one a movie and one a TV series. It hasn't come together yet, but I think that would make a terrific movie, and I'd love to see it happen. A novel I wrote called The Accident was turned into a six-part series in France, and they did a beautiful job with it. Don Bedforth asks, if you could be a character in the books that you write, what character would you most likely be, a good guy or a bad guy? Well, first of all, so many bad things happen to the people in my books, I'm not sure I want to be any of them. But I think the one that I've actually come closest to, I wrote four comic thrillers before I had a hit with No Time for Goodbye 11 years ago. I was writing about a character named Zach Walker, kind of anal retentive, obsessive compulsive individual, and he ends up getting into a situation that puts him in contact with some very, very bad people, and he is in no way equipped to deal with them. He's a writer of science fiction novels, he's an ex-newspaper guy, he doesn't know the first thing about dealing with real evil people. And I really threw myself into Zach, because I would have no idea how to handle dealing with, you know, real bad, bad types. And so I tend to identify with those kinds of characters, the ones who have no idea what to do. That sums me up perfectly. April Smart asks, what was your hardest book to write and why? That's a great question, because some books, you know, you write them and that first draft, it's like capturing lightning in a bottle. It just worked. Everything just came together perfectly. And then there are the other books that don't, and you spend an awful lot of time reworking them. And I had two novels that I've spent over the years a lot of time doing edits on and rewriting. And one was The Accident. Another was A Tap on the Window. And I even did quite a bit of work on A Noise Downstairs. But A Tap on the Window was probably the hardest, because when you're writing a novel, you need a kind of a foundation, the underpinnings, like what is the event that drives all of the action? It's like the foundation for a house. If it's not strong, if it doesn't hold together, everything else that's on top of it is going to crumble. And the foundation of that novel finally concluded wasn't quite working. So I had to redo all of the underpinnings. So it was the biggest rewrite I ever did. And I think it turned out to be one of the best books that I've ever done. It's hard for me to kind of accept it that way. I look at that book and I think, wow, this one just about killed me. And everyone else reads it, people who know nothing about it, and they go, wow, this is one of your best books. And so it seems rude to argue with them and tell them maybe it isn't. But, you know, every book's different. Some give you a lot of trouble. Some are relatively easy. And you always hope the next one will be have minimal aggravations to it. Finally, Kate Maloney asks, if you could be stuck in an elevator with three people, living or dead, who would they be and why? Well, if they were three people that was in this book, by the end of the conversation, they'd all be dead. But I guess I would say, first of all, I'd like the first person to be an elevator technician. That would be someone I'd like to have. But if I couldn't have him, I think that I'd like to be stuck in an elevator with my dad, who I lost when I was 16 years old. And it would be nice to get caught up with him, and the elevator could be stuck for as long as it wants to be. I also think it'd be great to get stuck in an elevator with Barack and Michelle Obama. I think they're the two of the coolest people on the planet. I think it'd be really a lot of fun to just hang out with them. And they're both so smart, they could probably figure out how to get the elevator going again, too. So those are my choices. But I think number one is definitely an elevator repairman.
This is Jonathan McLean. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Elevator Pitch by Linwood Barclay. This program was produced by Mosaic Audio. The director was Casey Sticker. Executive producer Suzanne Franco Mitchell.
Text copyright 2019 by NJSB Entertainment. Production copyright 2019 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this.